All right, we're continuing on in Yale 2011, incredible conference. We're with Martin Thompson. How are you doing?
Hey, Charles. How are you doing?
Great. It's nice to see you, and thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Now, we've had several conversations over the course of the time here, off camera and maybe with a beer or not or so.
Yeah.
And you have some interesting ideas regarding the state of concurrency and concurrent programming. Can you share a little bit of this?
Yeah,
the audience?
I've been having a lot of fun with that over the last few years, actually going back 20-odd years nearly now. And one of the things I've been discovering is that when you've got contention, ultimately you cannot scale. And so if we are contending on any piece of memory or any external device, you have to manage that contention. There's two major ways you can do that. You can use locking techniques, or you can use some form of optimistic concurrency control by either taking a copy and replacing that copy. The locking techniques have got some obvious implications in that you end up just queuing up on those locks, and the management of the locks becomes a very huge cost.
Mm-hmm.
The other approach is to take the optimistic approach, but you still have the contention because the memory has to be copied and then swapped back in at the end of it. And if you're dealing with hardware, you can't even do that, so you have to take a lock-in approach. You can't take a copy of a piece of hardware, be that a network device or something else you're dealing with, so you're down to one choice.
Mm.
So ultimately, we need to remove this contention. And there's been techniques around for a long time, going right back to communicating sequential processes, whereby we have shared nothing architectures.
Mm-hmm.
And a shared nothing architecture scales very well, because there is no contention going on. So we can use all of these cores that are happening now in modern processors. We now have many of them. Let's run single threads of execution on each of those cores, and we pass data via message passing.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as your message passing implementation is efficient, we can scale very well.
Agreed. Now, those are big questions, though. I mean, Erlang, for example, you can have shared state or not,
mm-hmm.
but it's all message passing and what like that. But you don't really want to use it in sort of high performance
mm-hmm.
applications. So talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, what are you saying? Does it have to be a functional program? Can it be an imperative world? What?
Yeah.
Erlang can work very well, and as you point out, Erlang can have shared memory. Most recommendations are that you don't use the shared memory within Erlang. It raises issues around garbage collection, for example, where if you actually partition the heaps within Erlang, it's garbage collection much easier. There's no means of contention onto that data in the first place. People will argue that if you go with the shared model, it can make the message passing easier because you can just pass the reference to the data.
Mm.
It's a nice, alluring idea. It makes it seem simple, but you've got to then manage that contention, manage the garbage collection. And based on actual measurement, it's generally better to copy the data and not have contention because modern processors can do this really well.
Mm.
That's just a general concept. You're alluding to, is there other issues with functional approaches?
Mm.
Functional approaches are great, but there's some fundamental issues in modern hardware. For example, if you take a very immutable approach, and most run in managed runtime environments, as you're constantly allocating those objects, you're normally allocating them from an Eden-type space, so a young generation.
Mm.
And as you go around the wrong generation, it's a round-robin algorithm, typically, as you bump the pointer to allocate the next chunk of memory that you're going to do it. The problem is that memory space is usually so large that it doesn't fit in your cache.
Mm.
So by the time you come around again, you're guaranteeing a cache miss. As a result, this limits your throughput to what's going on.
Mm.
And the cost of cache misses on modern applications are the greatest limitation to throughput.
Absolutely.
You're looking at orders of magnitude now between going to main memory or getting an L1 cache hit. So cache hits are king. We must do that if we want great performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we could have great functional programming techniques and use immutable objects a lot if some of the processor vendors give us instructions that is not currently available. For example, if we could have an assembly level instruction that would give us a cache line zeroed without reading main memory, without having that cache miss, we would have lots of advantages to do very rich immutable techniques. Unfortunately, we don't have those instructions. So we cannot ignore the underlying hardware. So we can't just go around preaching that functional is the answer and we'll use immutable objects without paying attention to the underlying hardware.
Excellent. That's an excellent point, because we often spend all of our time up in the software layer.
Mm-hmm.
So come on, hardware people, let's help us out here. Now, you have also sort of a more radical sort of approach to the way you describe the current state of of not just programming languages, but programmers and the way they think about concurrent systems and asynchrony and parallelism. Can you share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we get too obsessed with the technology and we think too much about the syntax, the languages, the tools we play with. We don't focus enough on the domain, and in particular the modeling of those domains. And typically as a computer scientist, we deal with two domains. There's the domain of the end user business problem we're focusing on. That is so important. That's what pays the bills and keeps us employed. If we lose sight of that, it will degrade the reputation of us in our industry. So our primary objective is to understand the domain models of the users we're working for and giving them good service. The same thinking equally applies to the hardware. In that, let's not get obsessed by the technology, but let's look at the model for how that hardware works. It's back to that mechanical sympathy I was mentioning a second ago. If we understand the hardware and the model by which it works, we can get the best out of it. It's exactly the same thing as understanding the model of the business that we're dealing with. So let's express in our code those models, be they the hardware we're working with or the business domain we're dealing with. If we start programming by side effect by using techniques that are not the same as the model, or there's a translation step in that model, we're losing information and we're losing value in delivering that process.
How the machine actually works, there is a large chasm of misunderstanding or just ignorance.
Yes.
How do you get around that problem in your world?
I think it's about understanding the abstractions appropriately. It's not about divorcing yourself from it, but it's also not about understanding the intimate details. There's other good analogies elsewhere. I use the term mechanical sympathy a lot. It comes from Jackie Stewart, the great racing driver, three times World Formula One champion. He coined the term that the best drivers have a mechanical sympathy for the vehicles they're driving. They can then get the best out of that vehicle by working in harmony with it. It doesn't mean you need to know how to rebuild a gearbox, how to build an engine, or how to design those sort of things, but you've got to know how to get the best out of them. So you've just got to know the fundamentals of how they work. I would argue that in computer science, we hide behind these things as excuses, that you don't need to understand this stuff. I think you need to understand the fundamentals. And one good example is that is if I was a structural engineer or some sort of civil engineer, for example, I need to understand the compression strength of concrete. I need to understand the torsional strength of steel. I don't need to know how to manufacture them, but I'm not absolved from knowing the details of some of that for something I'm going to construct. So why should we not know what is possible on a modern CPU? What is the way a network generally works? Like, I'm not talking about intimate details, I'm talking about the fact that you send maximum transmission units, so there's certain block sizes that work in a certain way. Same with the disk. The disk is fundamentally a stream-based device that's actually divided up into blocks, so appreciating that you're reading and writing blocks at a time. If you're in Java, you're in C#, it doesn't really make that much difference. You're in a managed runtime environment. The language is syntactic sugar. Okay, some of them are more efficient than others to write things quickly, but I said, why is that any different from having an automatic gearbox in a car and one that allows you paddle shift? It works fundamentally the same way, but if you understand how it works, you can make choices at times that give you a more optimal outcome. So it's not that you need to go back to a stick shift, for example. You can still be using a paddle shift. It's easier to use, but you get the choices, but you must have the understanding of how it works. Otherwise, you drive a car around in first gear all of the time, just revving it and getting nowhere. So much code is written today, it's like people don't understand that they've actually got a gearbox and they can change gears. So the productivity languages are fine, but why are we applying them in certain ways at certain times? We should know why. It's understanding the reasons. We're not absolved from understanding what's going on underneath.
Let's move to Disruptor. What is it for people out there who don't know? And how? And without getting into too many details, what does it afford?
10,000-foot view is it lets you very efficiently pass messages or events between threads of execution in much faster ways than, say, modern queue-based techniques. You'd be looking at maybe three orders of magnitude, I'm not saying percentage points, three orders of magnitude difference on latency, and 1 to 2 orders of magnitude difference on throughput as the standard queue-based techniques and locks because of how they're designed. It's not actually fundamentally new. It's a nice implementation of techniques that have been around a long time. We, in addition to being able to pass messages between threads, we can actually organize those threads into a graph of dependencies for doing a workflow or any sort of process of inputs flowing through various processing stages to eventually give us outputs. The disruptor just allows us to do that very efficiently. The ideas have come from things like CSP in the past. It uses techniques like ring buffers, so we don't have to keep allocating objects, they get reused. Exactly the same sort of techniques you'll find in modern network cards. We don't use lock, we use non-blocking algorithms and memory barriers where we've got multiple threads contending. We even try to avoid that and use the raw memory model directly. If you were writing an operating system or hardware devices, these techniques are quite familiar. Just within the application programming world today, a lot of people aren't using them. It's been, some people look at the disruptor and go, wow, this is new and interesting. It's kind of new and interesting just for appearing right now in the current world, but there's actually nothing new and interesting from techniques. I like to think it's a good execution of a bunch of great work that's gone from the past. In physics, we talk about building on the shoulders of giants, one of the famous comments from Newton. In computer science, we should be doing the same.
Sure.
Let's look to our past, let's understand the great work, and let's build on it and take it forward.
Excellent. Now, for the consumers of Disruptor, and going back to your initial point, I mean, in some sense, you've abstracted away the machine model for them and provided them with a relatively simple to use API, I would imagine. Can you talk about the experience for the developer using the Disruptor and sort of their conceptual model is going to be slightly more abstract than the one?
The abstractions are a really useful technique whenever they're applicable. So if the abstraction is a good abstraction of the models that I mentioned earlier, so we're talking now of the model of the underlying hardware and how threads of execution run and how messages are passed between those threads. So the disruptors are very good one-to-one mapping between having multiple cores and using the cache subsystem as the means of message passing between those cores. You don't need to get down into the assembly language to understand what's going on. You don't need to understand about the memory model because that's taken care of. So it's a useful abstraction coming up to that level. And then people can program just in events. So it's effectively an event-driven asynchronous programming paradigm that's quite comfortable to get used to, but gives you the benefits of driving that underlying hardware as efficiently as possible.
Now, you know, when you think about what the people who normally, like, they're talking about Java, the language, I know that the JVM supports many more languages, and in fact, Java, as Ola Bini says, is pretty much legacy. That's debatable, but that's, it's an interesting way to think about that. People who, the Java developers are essentially going to be imperative thinkers, right? That's their conceptual model.
Yes.
And so when you give them, you know, asynchrony kind of throws a wrench into that sort of happy, easy, beautiful way of thinking and sort of sequential blah, blah, blah. Do you provide a nice sequential model that feels like I'm writing sequential code even though I'm doing asynchronous things? Like, for example, the async await model in C#. That's sort of what I'm thinking.
Okay, yeah. We're doing something quite different in that it's purely just an event-based system. So events come in, you respond to events, and then you can generate further events going forward from that. It's not any more complicated in that it's not a framework that lets you do this over multiple steps within the same process. That's a different space, and we're not looking at that. So purely just an event-based system. Very similar to, if you were to think of how transputers work, you've got individual threads of execution. You can do whatever you like inside that thread. You could take an imperative approach. You could take a functional approach. You could take whatever approach suits you best. You just choose that between those threads of execution, you pass messages in a very efficient manner.
You seem to think that the way that we try to solve these problems today are overly complex, right? I mean, the just passing messages should be the just, it's just the way we should talk. Like we're talking right now, we're passing you messages.
It's how nature operates. It's how hardware operates. We build a model. We build a set of abstractions, and that abstraction has an impedance mismatch. That is going to have issues long term. I think it becomes one of those cases of whereby you get into a synchronous programming model and it initially seems easier. But then you start dealing with failure cases. You start dealing with how do you make some of that composable and reused elsewhere. It starts getting quite difficult at that stage, whereas an asynchronous model initially seems, oh, this is odd, because we normally taught synchronous programming models to begin with, so that looks different. So it puts some people off a bit. But once you get into it, the complexity doesn't keep going up. You start off at a slightly higher bar, but it stays at that point. Whereas you get into synchronous models, it lures you in thinking it's easy, and it starts getting exponentially harder, especially as you factor in failure cases. give a really good example is that if you're interfacing with the third-party system, for example, if you wanted to do a payment transfer, you would make the request to do payment transfer with the other system. If you do it in a synchronous fashion, most of the time it's going to work. What happens when it doesn't work? What's the typical programmer do? Well, generally, they don't even consider catching that case. And so systems typically end up falling over in production because the happy path is only tested. Or they may have thought about it a bit more and they've got an exception handler. And that's a weird, slightly weird type of code. If you take an asynchronous approach, you naturally model it as a state machine saying, I'm sending a request now to do a payment transfer. I've now transitioned state into that. It's pending. It's now in progress. I'm waiting on a response. If you don't get the response back after a while, you're looking at, well, okay, fine. You can, something's going to look at the state of your machine and say, okay, I need a timeout now on that. And it becomes quite a natural thing to add that in. You can see a number of requests pending, and you can deal with them in a batch. You can deal with them cleanly at that point. And it becomes very natural seeing what's going on, and it's not hidden by side effect in some exception handler. So you go to test it, you're just testing events. So you test the event that you sent it, you test an event that it comes back successfully. You test an event that it's timed out. You may test an event that it's partially processed and got broken in some way. These all become nice, simple, discrete test cases, all first-class citizens. Why should the exception not be a first-class citizen the way the success path is? Why is that different? That's harder for someone to fit in their head, that they've actually got multiple ways of doing stuff. As humans, we do really well with just, let's do it in one way. So you make the argument about productivity and different languages. I think productivity is so important in that we design languages that make us productive, but let's make us productive with good techniques. It could be controversial and say highly productive languages make sort of developers who are not so good very productive. So what you get then, a lot of not very good code.
How do you write a how would I use sort of this asynchronous model that you're talking about, or this modeling before I start writing code? Have you experimented with doing that with JavaScript?
Yeah, I've written for a bit of JavaScript in my time as well. I think what's interesting is people start off writing applications in JavaScript. When they're little toys, that's fine. Then you start developing quite a rich and complex UI. You start running into performance problems. What you do then, you spend a lot of time experimenting, trying to work out how this is working under the covers. So what have you done with the abstractions at that point? Well, you're trying to work out how they're actually implemented rather than making them clear first-class citizens. JavaScript is so flexible, it causes people to implement in ways that the models are not predictable. For example, an object is one type of first-class entity inside JavaScript, an array is another type. An array is a specialization of an object. But you can put many properties onto an object and make it appear like an array. You have that level of flexibility. What happens when you've got that level of flexibility? Some people use it. And you've got now an impedance mismatch. Now, this is really difficult for the VM implementers, because how do they start optimizing for all of those sorts of weird behaviors? Let's make the models more explicit and make them clear. It makes the runtime easier to design, and it makes the code easier to understand and debug. So with that level of flexibility, how do you come into a project when people do so many weird and wonderful things with the language because it allows it to then understand and pick that language up quickly?
What are your thoughts on pure functional programming?
I think it's great that we've got this huge range of languages that are expanding, that are trying to solve these problems, because it's kind of, it's a good example of nature. We have to have lots of mutations, and by mutations I mean trying new ideas. Is how any species normally gets to advance. We try these because no one person is going to think of every possible way we can solve these sort of problems. We try them, we experiment, some are going to succeed, some of them are going to fail for many different reasons. I think the more of this we get, actually the better, but some will come and some will go, and we'll get failures and we'll get successes. I think some of the functional ideas around immutability and how we can compose different types of functionality is great. It'll help us move forward. You can question whether the average developer is ready for this now. So the average human is very intelligent, but we're not going through the right sort of training programs within technology to get the best out. I've seen so many teams whereby the product that they produce is not a fair representation of the intelligence of those teams. And that has got to come down to one of a number of things. Who knows for sure what's causing it? Is it that our education system isn't right? Is it that people aren't serving in an apprenticeship? Is it the management of those teams don't totally respect what it takes to deliver a technology project. Mm. I don't think the languages give it, but they give us an interesting way we're experimenting and going forward. Mm. They'll drive the hardware, they'll drive different ways of thinking. I think the abstractions are useful to experiment with. Mm-hmm. What level of success they'll have in the real world, I'm not sure. It's interesting that the most successful languages are quite often not very clever.
Agreed. It's interesting, isn't it? Now, or they're very different. Like, if you look at C and C++ versus, you know, Java and C#, mm-hmm. and then Ruby and PHP and Python and blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. Those are sort of the things that a lot of people are using, right? And JavaScript, of course. Mm-hmm. Very different languages. With C++, you get power. The price you pay is complexity. Mm-hmm. And they're actually cleaning that up in C++ 11 for sure. But it's still it's a big language. It's complex, but it's very powerful.
Yes.
You know this because you're a C++ developer, mm-hmm. and you've spent plenty of time writing C++ code. So I do want to get sort of your perspective on that. I mean, what's your thought on where we are today with these C-based languages, and in particular with C++?
I think tooling is one of the important things with any language. The language itself can almost be incidental. One example is Java is flawed in many, many ways, but the tooling and surrounding environments are second to none, which really gives it an advantage. So C++ being a great example of having the performance and the power. I love the ability to define things with templates, but you can get very complex very quickly, and you can get into a lot of fun trying to debug in that. So what are the tools up to? If the tools are there, it makes a big difference. It's not just the language. It's the whole ecosystem that needs to be there to make this happen.
Agreed. And that's sort of, there's a lot of small talkers at this event, and that was sort of the great thing about small talk. The language was the tool, right? There was no separation between writing your code and executing your code as you're writing it in the tool itself. What's sort of the big problem you're working on these days?
Mostly I've started talking to clients and performance is an issue. Mm-hmm. People generally approach performance as an afterthought. And it has a number of interesting consequences. As people become successful as businesses, they can run into the issue of performance and their systems need to be adjusted to deal with that. Mm. It may not just be an outright transaction issue. It can be a limitation of hardware. For example, people are struggling now to get space in data centers to run the sufficient amount of hardware to deliver the performance they need. It's becoming very costly. Mm. I kind of see the future as we need to start asking questions, and it's not about how fast we make something, get obsessed with profiling and optimizing to the extreme, but what is the number of joules per transaction we're actually operating? We need to start thinking about these things, because as we keep using up all the energy we have on the planet, we need to start working out how we do things a bit more efficiently.
Absolutely. Right on. Well, good luck to you, and solve that problem, will you? Right on. Thanks for coming on Channel 9, man.
Great.
Cheers.